listening to In Layman's Terms, a podcast dedicated to stories of discipleship, news from the United Methodist Church, and lessons from Scripture. I'm your host, Todd Seifert, and as the Communications Director in the Great Plains Conference and a certified lay minister in the UMC, it's my privilege to share these reflections with you. The United Methodist Church is finally scheduled to conduct its general conference from April 23rd to May 4th, 2024 in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's been 8 years since delegates from the annual conferences around the world have gathered to sort through legislation related to governance and the witness of the denomination. Thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic and related issues regarding visas for people from outside the United States, we've had postponement after postponement. So in 2024, we're finally gathering with what will be known as the 2020 General Conference. The 862 delegates, including 7 each of clergy and laity, 14 total, from the Great Plains Conference will sort through more than 1,800 pages of legislation. Many of those pages contain proposed changes to the United Methodist Book of Discipline. While there are many topics, three have risen to the top in the minds of many people. They are removal of restrictive, some would say harmful, language from the discipline regarding LGBTQ+ persons, regionalization, which is a process meant to provide flexibility and better equity across the denomination, and revision of the denomination's social principles, which are statements of stances the denomination takes on current events and concerns. It's the first major revision of that document in decades. Now, originally, I'd intended to take one episode for each of those topics, but all three of those subjects are so intertwined that it felt like separating them left out important context from each of my guests. So instead, we're getting 5 episodes about the upcoming General Conference. In each case, you're hearing discussions between myself and folks like Conference Lay Leader Lisa Maupin, Reverends Adam Hamilton, Mark Holland, Amy Lippolt, and David Livingston. In each case, we address their thoughts on those three subjects, known to many as the three R's. But also in each case, well, each one of them has some unique perspectives, and so you'll hear those as well. In this episode, Reverend David Livingston, pastor of Old Mission United Methodist Church in Fairway, Kansas, provides some important historical perspectives and tells us about his travels to the African continent and elsewhere. He recently welcomed me to his church so we could sit down and have this discussion. Here's my conversation with David. David, let's start off by talking about what have become some of the key elements or goals for the General Conference in Charlotte, North Carolina, coming up in April. It's known as the three R's. So the first one of those, just in my list here, there are different people have different priorities, but removing the restrictive language, I think, is what a lot of people seem to think, that, and I'm talking about the casual Methodist here, think that's the only reason we're really getting together. That's not the case, and we'll get into that in a moment, but tell me about the restrictive language. What is that goal, particularly for progressives and centrists?
Yeah, I think going back briefly to 2019, the General Conference that we had that year, what came out of that was very restrictive language, more so than what we already had in terms of inclusion of LGBT plus people. And then we had in the U.S. really a revolt against that within the denomination. So a lot of people saw that next year's General Conference, which now has become the 5 years later General Conference, as the solution to that problem. So removing what we call the harmful language, the restrictive language, is certainly the most hot button kind of topic that we have at General Conference. And the hope that we have is that we'd be able to simply do what that suggests, that we would remove language that has been found to be harmful and restrictive of LGBT plus participation in the church. So it's not replacing that language with other language, but just removing that, which then allows for more openness than what we have now.
Yeah, we're not adding more affirmative language. We're just hoping to take out language that has been added that's very restrictive.
That's right. Essentially, the church's position becomes a neutral position.
And it goes all the way back to as long as I've been alive.
Longer than I've been alive.
1972.
Yeah.
We have the same birthday, but not the same year, folks.
That's right.
I've got in by at least a couple, I think. So that's the first one. The second one is one that I think has intimidated people. But I think it's very important for folks to understand that regionalization, yes, the polity components, the law components to get it passed and ratified is complicated. The concept is not. Let's focus on the concept first.
Yeah, the concept is really pretty simple. So As it stands right now, we actually have a kind of regionalization. We have in the United States our jurisdictions. Outside of the United States, we have our central conferences. So in the United States, we've got seven states that are together in a jurisdiction, but outside those central conferences are usually multiple countries that are together. And those central conferences have the authority right now to make changes to the Book of Discipline that fit their cultural context. In some cases, it's not even the cultural context, but it's a resource context. I'm aware of one conference that recently called a special conference under the authority of the 1990 Book of Discipline. There is no 1990 Book of Discipline. Those will only come out every 4 years. Somebody did a special translation of the 1988 Book of Discipline for this country's use, and they've been using it for the last 34 years. So those countries have that opportunity, but in the United States, that's not the case. And so regionalization in its most fundamental form just simply says the United States should also be able to be a central conference so that the U.S. can also make adjustments to the Book of Discipline as needed. Not to every component of the Book of Discipline. The essentials of the faith all would remain protected in what's called the General Book of Discipline, but many things would be adjustable. That's really important because it's actually, I've thought about this as a hypothetical, but I've recently have realized it's not even hypothetical. This really happened. The reality is that with the shifting demographics that we have now in the United Methodist Church, it would be possible for a majority from outside of any one region to currently create a petition that could pass, which would bind only the U.S. to an action, and others would have the freedom to not have that take place for them. The example is the disaffiliation petition in 2553 that was passed at the 2019 General Conference. The majority of the U.S. voted against it, and the only people who are bound by it are those of us in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And it only passed by about 50 votes.
It was a very close vote. But yeah, so a majority of people outside the U.S. passed something that is that we in the U.S. are bound to, but nobody else is bound to. That just seems fundamentally unfair. I mean, in the United States, we fought a war about that once upon a time. it seems fundamentally unfair, and so this rectifies that.
And it probably wouldn't be looked at very favorably if that was in reverse.
Absolutely, right? That would be colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is interesting. As a guy who grew up Baptist, but I've been a United Methodist for 25 years plus, but still the concepts of this democratic governance is every time I think I've got it figured out, something else happens.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, one of the great things about a denomination, but it can also be a weakness. And this is not a new concept either, by the way. So regionalization as a concept passed the General Conference in 2008 and then was not ratified by enough conferences around the world. One of the big reasons for that, even though it was actually the group that proposed it, was led by Scott Jones, our former bishop, who's very traditional, but ultimately it was voted down because of concerns from traditionalists that it would be used to do something like remove the restrictive language. So that was, you know, 16 years ago. The times have changed now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, demographics and feelings of people across the United States, if you look at polls, are dramatically different today than they were back in those days.
And even somewhat in Africa and the Philippines. I mean, I remember in the 2008 General Conference, I remember somebody who happened to be from one of the countries in Africa who stood up and on the floor of General Conference said, "I don't know why we're even talking about this when these are people who are going to hell." You don't hear that now. I remember people would say, you know, in our context, we can't even have a conversation. We can't even use these words. But now that's not so much the case. So there's a lot of change all over the world.
We're going to come back to that concept in just a few moments, but I want to hit the third R, which is a revision of the social principles. Let's first of all talk about what are the social principles for folks that don't understand what those are, and then get into what some of these changes would be that progressives and centrists tend to believe are going to be helpful for a long time.
Yeah, so the social principles are a series of statements that the United Methodist Church makes on a variety of social issues. Many of them are very non-controversial. There's one on the proper use of outer space, which I don't think anybody would argue with. And then there are some, like abortion, that are very controversial. And by a 50% plus one majority, these are the things that United Methodists at General Conference said we believe. So when I teach on the social principles, I usually start by saying, if you read through this book of all of these social principles, I promise you will find at least one thing that you say to yourself, I'm so glad that our church says this. And at least one thing that you say, I can't believe I'm part of a church that would say this. They're not things that we all are going to agree on, and we would say that that's okay. The social principles have been around in one form or another since the very beginning of the denomination, and so that's, you know, 50 years old plus. But the revised social principles are intended to do a couple of things. One, they're broader. So these don't have as many topics as our current social principles do. And one of the reasons for that is because, second, they are really supposed to be global. As we've become a more global church, it's important for us to be clear about what really does apply everywhere and at all times, and what is more temporal, what's more based on the location that we are or the times that we're in. So
the world has changed a lot since 1968, 1972. In 2024, the world's a very different place.
That's exactly right. And some of the social principles can always be revised. So there have been revisions to particular principles since 68. But some of those we just need to start over with. One of the things that's really unique about the social principles, too, is that it has to be by far the most vetted document that we've had in our history. I mean, it was developed, remember, for the 2020 General Conference, which is happening now 4 years later. It was also developed by probably the first time we've ever really had a global conversation about something. So there were many people in the U.S. who were involved in drafting it, but there were also people from all the other central conferences, all the other countries of the United Methodist Church that were involved. It originated from the General Board of Church and Society, and they had staff members go to many different countries to not just for the writing, but then for the review of it. What are you hearing about this that's unhelpful? What is helpful? One of the things that, as a good example of this, that came up was adoption. So adoption is one of the topics that's covered. And we would think about adoption as kind of a no-brainer, right? Why would we not encourage adoption? Well, there's some countries within, again, back to Africa, there's some countries within Africa where that's not something that is seen as a no-brainer. The first choice should not be adoption. The first choice for an unwanted baby should be extended family, and not adoption by some random person who you don't know. And so those are the kinds of things that from a U.S. perspective needed to be really thought out and in a different way. So they've done an exceptional job of that.
We have at least two people that I know of from the Great Plains who took part in that process. Reverend Dr. Kalaba Chali was on the writing team, and I believe Reverend Cindy Cargis, who's the district superintendent in the Gateway and Great West districts, also was a part. So we have two DSs that I know for sure had a role to play. I'm not clear on exactly what their roles were within it, other than I know they were both part of that team that worked for revision, which is kind of cool for our conference, I think, to have at least a couple of people. And there may be more. Those are just the two that I know of.
Yeah, those two were, I believe, both involved in the writing process. And then again, virtually every conference would have had some participation in the review process, the presentations and the workshops and asking for feedback. It's been, as I said, it's been very well vetted.
This is one of the few things we could probably say has probably seen more eyeballs than just about anything else.
Yeah. Now, however, because one of the items of the social principles is human sexuality and marriage, it still is controversial. So that one piece in particular could be changed at General Conference. The proposal is to say that marriage is between two people. A number of people want that to specify it's between a man and a woman. Some people want the language about marriage to go away altogether. And so there's a number of different possibilities for how that could actually turn out at General Conference.
The interesting thing about General Conference, for folks who aren't familiar with it, is it really does look like Congress. It's 862 people this time around. That's the number of total delegates. They will make motions, they'll make amendments, they'll vote. It's going to look a lot like a legislative process if you've never seen it before, or if you've just forgotten what it looks like because it's been so long since we got together. Basically, anything can happen. That's the thing that people need to understand, is all the things that we're talking about in this episode are plans, they are goals. There is no guarantee of what's going to happen once that plenary floor opens up.
That's exactly right. Anything can happen. And it's going to be live streamed, so you'll be able to watch it and watch as anything happens.
And we'll have the link to that directly on the Great Plains website. So each day when you get up, if you want to watch the whole thing, you can go to the greatplainsumc.org website and click the link. It'll take you straight to the live stream. So we'll make it as easy as we can for you to follow along. So David, you've been on the road.
It's true.
Not so much road, flights. You've been in planes. You've been in planes for long times. I know one thing that you did was you went to Tanzania as part of a group of folks. I asked you to talk a little bit about that. First of all, why go to Africa? Let's help people understand the context. And what did you do there? And then we'll come back with a couple other questions after that.
Sure, yeah. I had my longest plane flight ever from Paris to Zanzibar, and then the shortest plane flight ever, which was 18 minutes from Zanzibar to Dar es Salaam, so two parts of Tanzania. So there's a group in Africa that some people are familiar with called the African Initiative. The African Initiative is a very traditionalist group. It's funded and partners with the Westland Covenant Association, they have been the group who really has been seen as spokespeople for Africa, aside from the bishops. That's the group that's been seen as spokespeople for Africa. In the last couple of years or so, there's another group that's formed that's called the African Forum. And the African Forum is not the African Initiative. It's a group who have said they don't speak for us and we need to have our own voice. And so that group wanted to have a conference. They've had their own internal meetings before, but they wanted to have a conference that they could invite delegates to General Conference from across the continent of Africa to. And they wanted to have a handful of folks from the U.S. There was probably 20 or so of us from the U.S. who were there, 15 maybe, to help with interpretation of what's going on, to build relationships with one another, and to prepare for General Conference. I think one of the things that I've learned is that the approach that we took was very different from the approach that some other groups have taken. I read a piece from Tom Lambrecht, who's Vice President of Good News, who said, I'm sure when they were in Dar es Salaam that the U.S. group was speaking a lot about the specific petitions to pass. And I wrote him back and I said, well, no, you guys might do that when you go over to Africa, but that's actually not at all what we did. We were guests. And so we acted like guests, and we spoke when we were asked to speak, and we were not speaking when we weren't asked to speak. We never talked about any specific petitions in front of General Conference. We did talk about some concepts, and we built relationships and had good conversation with each other. So it was entirely led and formed by the African Forum themselves. About 160 or so people from Africa who were there, and like I said, probably 15 to 20 from the U.S. or other parts of the world.
So what was your takeaway, as you were on that long flight back? Mm-hmm. Get there, that long flight, you got to take that same flight back. What was the feeling as you left, after you had a chance to interact and get to meet some of these folks, from a very different context of ministry than what you have here in Fairway, Kansas?
So I'll say three things about what I took away. One is that for the group that was there, it was clear that we still have differences when it comes to human sexuality. So at one point, they have followed a different process, but not completely dissimilar to what we do at General Conference and an annual conference. There's resolutions, there's amendments, and so on. And so they endorsed, for example, the social principles, but endorsed an amendment to the social principles that would specify marriages between one man and one woman. Saying one man, one woman is important for them, not only because of, well, the man and the woman is important, and so is one person of each gender, because there's issues with polygamy in Africa as well. Mm-hmm. So that clarification was really important for them. So we still are separated by that. And at the same time, second, there was unanimity among that group that regionalization would be a good idea. So here in the U.S., we have a number of us who, myself included, are very committed to regionalization and very committed to removing the language. And we've got people in Africa who are very committed to keeping the language intact and to staying United Methodist. Regionalization is the way that we can do that. So those were clear. The third piece that I would say that's still unclear for me, and I think, frankly, is unclear for everybody in the United States, is, for lack of a better way of saying it, who really represents the continent of Africa? And we have to remember, it's a continent. It's not a country. And even if it were a country, you know, we can't really say in the U.S. who represents the U.S. There is no one person or one group that represents all of the U.S. So would the majority of people in Africa identify more with the African Initiative agenda, or would they identify more with the people of the Africa Forum? And we will find that out when we arrive at General Conference.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is interesting, it's always been kind of the elephant in the room. I shouldn't say always. I've only been at this since 2015. So this is my second regular General Conference. The 2019, I really don't even count that. That was just such a weird experience. But it was always kind of the elephant in the room when I've been there, and that's the whole financial tie between the United States paying the bulk of the apportionments that fund a lot of the church on the African continent. That creates an odd dynamic, I think, and I'm not articulating this very well, but I wonder, was there any kind of discussion about that at all among folks there? Is this acknowledging that that might be a sticking point, or is this the idea that, you know, if things don't pass the way they want, there's a very real possibility that American churches start with, at the very least, start withholding some funding that would have helped the African churches continue in their mission?
Yeah, that's a good question. To the best of my memory, there was no conversation there about what I'll call ramifications of votes at General Conference. There were some informal conversations, but nothing formally. And I think that the way that you said that, I think, is good, Todd, the way you posed that question. And I think that we do need to be realistic. Some people might view it as a threat. I just think it's just true that if we don't have significant changes, then just as there were churches, 25% of the U.S. churches left from the denomination because they were afraid of changes, if there aren't changes, 25% or more other churches will leave. And that would have significant ramifications, I mean, you know, throughout the globe, significant ramifications here in the U.S., but even more significant in Africa, less in Africa, but still significant in the Philippines as well, for what happens there, what we can afford to do there. So I would say, I guess the one way in which that kind of came up was that Africa was, one General Conference can't bind the next one, so it's not a promise, but they were told basically that they could anticipate having five new bishops, and there will not be five new bishops. There's not the money now to do that, but there might be one or two new bishops in Africa, and if regionalization doesn't pass, if removing the language doesn't pass, you know, it's hard to imagine where that could happen. So they endorsed, the African Forums group endorsed one, I believe, new bishop, and it could be the understanding of those financial realities was a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have no knowledge about that whatsoever. I just know that I never heard that spoken of until mm-hmm. after 2019, and just how off the rails that special session got compared to what folks were considering was going to happen. There's a lot of hope about the One Church plan. And when that derailed, I know at least us cynical communicators up in the loft of the arena, and we were way up there by the ceiling, that was a lot of discussion. And honestly, I guess I always kind of thought that, but I had never really heard it said out loud. And I've heard that more often in my travels, not nearly as the kind of travels that you've had over the last few months especially. So,
well, and again, I don't think of that as a threat. I think of that as just a reality. I mean, it's hard. If you have people as a pastor, if you have people in your congregation who are LGBT, it's difficult to say to them, you know, you really should give to this church, which is treating you unfairly. And it's difficult to say to the people who are sitting around that individual, you know, you should really give to this church, even though it's treating somebody who you love and care about unfairly. That's pretty difficult to do. So it's just the reality of what's going to happen if we don't have some significant success at General Conference. Everybody needs to understand this time around what the ramifications are going to be.
Mm-hmm. What is your feel? I mean, you're obviously much better connected than I am. You've been at this a lot longer, and so you just know way more people than I do, to be totally honest with you. The makeup of the room is going to be different at General Conference, at least from the United States delegations standpoint. So roughly this time around, roughly 55% of the delegates are from the United States, 45% from outside. That number flips in 4 years. But for now, that's the number. How do you feel like, based on your discussions with folks, do you feel like there's going to be a different atmosphere in the room compared to what we've seen in the past? Because you're no rookie to General Conference either. You were a delegate in 2016. I know for sure. I don't know what was before that.
2008, I was an alternate. In 1996, as a recent college graduate, was my first time to be there.
Okay. Yeah. So you've seen this. So you're probably better positioned than anybody else that I've spoken with so far. Do you feel like there's going to be a different tenor in the room this time around? Or is that just not anything to even consider right now?
I'll take you back in time again, back to 2019. 2019, after that General Conference that everybody thought went horribly, and you know, even the people who won the votes felt horrible about how it happened. That summer at annual conferences, we were electing delegates for what we thought would be a General Conference 1 year later. I was on vacation. We were at a theme park. We were in line actually for the new Harry Potter, Hagrid's Magical Journey ride or something like that.
I'm so glad you said that, because I remember us talking about it after you got back.
Oh, it was a great ride, by the way. If you have a chance to go there, you really should. It was fantastic. Anyway, we were in line for that, and it was like an 8-hour line. It was crazy. But I was getting these texts. I won't say the conference, but I was getting these texts from somebody in a conference, and it said, you'll never believe what happened in this conference. We just took the vote, and on the first ballot, all of the laity were elected, and they were the progressive centrist laity. And I said, no, you've misunderstood. I know that conference well enough to know that that's not going to happen. That's not possible. And they said, no, really. I looked it up. I had good web service. So I looked it up. Sure enough, it's what happened. I mean, there was, Todd, I don't know how else to say it, 2019, that summer at annual conferences, there was just a full-on rebellion in the U.S. to what General Conference passed. And we saw that then. We haven't had our General Conference, but we did have in 2022 a jurisdictional conference. And all five jurisdictional conferences, this is where we elect our bishops, had the same result. For the first time that I know of in the history of the United Methodist Church, identical petitions were submitted to each of the five jurisdictions. They affirmed the things that we're talking about today, and they passed at all of the five of those jurisdictions. The bishops that were elected were unanimously progressive and centrist bishops. In our jurisdiction, the South Central jurisdiction, which along with the Southeast were the two that were hardest hit with disaffiliations. You know, this we include Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri. So, more conservative, and we elected three bishops on the first ballot. That had never happened before in history, and people kept saying to me, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. It's going to happen. First ballot, maybe second ballot. I'm like, nah, look, I appreciate your optimism, but we've been around long enough to know better. That's not what happens.
Because it took us 40-something ballots in 2016.
Exactly. So we went from, in 2016, the most ballots in history for electing all of our bishops, to in 2022, the fewest ballots possible to elect our bishops. And the only explanation for that is people understood what they were elected to do and they did it. So in 2019, the U.S. delegates, there was probably about a 65-35 split between support for what we're trying to accomplish in 2024 and opposition. So it was the majority of the U.S. was in favor of eliminating the language and so on, but not a massive majority. And this year it's probably 90%. It's a remarkable change. And there will still be, and this is important, activists from the Global Methodist Church, not even from traditionalist groups within the United Methodist Church, but there will be people who are full-blown, like the day after General Conference is over, I'm moving my membership to the GMC, who will be there and advocating. It's important to note, there will not be United Methodists at the Global Methodist Church as convening General Conference. We won't be there, but they will be at ours. So it's not going to be a complete kumbaya, even within the U.S., right? But I'm optimistic that it will be much more civil than what it was in 2019.
I know, so like I said, I haven't been involved in the church's politics for all that long, but because of my previous role as a journalist, I was heavily involved in political things in the past. And I've seen with my own eyes when a group took something a little too far and it caused a backlash, the pendulum swung back. And that's really what I witnessed in 2019. Yeah. The first time I'd seen that in the church context, but I firmly believe that's what happened.
Yeah, I agree.
Just because I'd seen that before with internal politics stuff within a state before, and it just felt exactly the same.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Now, that means too that there are certainly those within the U.S. in particular who would really like to go further than what we reasonably could go in terms of inclusion for this time around. So there will be petitions that say that pastors have to do same-sex marriages, or there'll be at least one petition that would make gender identity a protected status in the same way that race and gender are protected statuses within the denomination. And that second one would require a constitutional amendment, which just flat out wouldn't be able to pass. I think it's important to note too that all of the various caucus groups and organizations that are working together are unanimous that, thinking about 2019, that would be too far. So really, the extent of what we're talking about is that officially neutral kind of position for the denomination on same-sex marriage and on gender identity.
Mm-hmm. Before we close, I want to get into a couple of not little more mundane types of things here. Mm-hmm. I want to explain for folks how legislation moves to the General Conference, because they may not understand that. We start off with legislative committees, and that's basically the whole first week is committees, or folks are assigned to committees, and they go to those committees and they have discussion, just like in Congress, like I said earlier. Let's use you as an example. Can you tell folks what committee you are a part of, and just what some of the pieces of legislation that committee is dealing with, just so they get an idea of how this system works outside of these really big topics that we've been discussing?
Yeah, so I'm on the Ordained Ministry Committee, and we have a few of the petitions that are relevant to what we've been talking about. We've got petitions on same-sex marriage specifically, but the Ordained Ministry Committee mostly has petitions related to the ordination process or the rights of clergy. We've got a report from a study committee on the nature of ordination, and they would like to continue that study, and they have a document that they'd like for the churches, not completely dissimilar from what we talked about with the global social principles. They've got a document they want there to be consideration of and review of. We've got some petitions that would change the educational requirements or allow more flexibility for the educational requirements for clergy. The question about should deacons have the right to perform the sacraments, communion and baptism, That's been a question for a few years now, and there's petitions about that. So there's significant issues, but they're not the same kind of hot buttons that we're talking about.
They're definitely more inside baseball types of things as opposed to these very high profile of interest to people outside the denomination.
Yeah, that's right. And the other piece kind of related to that too, there's 1,300 pages that we have, not for our committee, but for all of the committees combined, about 1,300 pages of petitions. So it's an enormous amount of
the whole document is 1,880 something pages.
And they all require a vote. So every petition by our rules has to get an up or down vote. 90% of those votes will come in committee by a large margin, because also any United Methodist member can submit a petition. So there's a lot of petitions that really are just not very good petitions, and they will be voted down right away. And there's many others that require a great deal of consideration. There's many that do the same kind of thing. You'll see some petitions where it's listed as submitted by, we'll just say my name, submitted by David Livingston, and then it will note 17 similar petitions. So 18 people thought this was something we should do, and we're only going to print one of them, but there were a whole lot of others. That can happen as well.
Mm-hmm. Because when you have a denomination this size, there's a lot of folks that can submit, and there's no reason to have to read the same thing 18 times.
That's exactly right. So, yeah.
Something you said just a few minutes ago, a few seconds ago, struck me as we talk about these petitions and we talk about this issue of disaffiliation. You may not know the answer to this, but I think it's important for people to know that this is something being considered. What happens if someone who has now disaffiliated submitted one of those petitions and it goes to the General Conference for consideration? Does it become null and void because they're no longer part of it? Or is it because it's already in the system, it's going to be dealt with? I know there's some question about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. So you have to be a member of the United Methodist Church to submit a petition, but that's the extent of that language. To use another example from our conference, one that we still mourn, Junius Dotson passed away. He had submitted a number of petitions before his death. Those don't become invalid because he's no longer a member of the temporal United Methodist Church and is part of the Church Eternal instead. So those petitions, my understanding is that the current position of the
Commission on General Conference.
Thank you. Yes. General Commission on General Conference.
I was trying to think of what, there's so many.
Yes, there's too many abbreviations. The position right now is that any petition that was submitted by a person who has since disaffiliated is still valid and must be dealt with.
And that could happen. Different committees may deal with those differently.
So that's right. So there will be, I'm pretty confident, there will be some committees who simply say, here's a list of the petitions that were submitted by disaffiliated people. We're not going to read any of these. We're going to say these should all just be set aside. So we'll vote collectively, we'll vote no on all of those petitions without even opening the book to see what they say, just kind of as a matter of principle. And again, you know, that if you're in favor of that, that goes back to the principle that somebody who has said, I don't want to be part of the denomination anymore, why should they have influence on the denomination? Some of those petitions too would be similar to others that have not left the denomination, so that would need to be attended to as well. It doesn't mean that the topic that they introduce will not be dealt with, but it would mean that their particular petition would not be dealt with.
Right. There's a lot of stuff that we'll sort out once we get to Charlotte.
There will be a lot of sorting out, 2 full weeks of it, about a week with the, 3 days actually with the committees, and then a lot of times for us all together with that group of 860 folks who are gathered together in that one room. And, you know, they say if you put 2 people together, you'll get 3 opinions. Well, imagine with 860 what you're going to get.
From multiple continents.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Multiple languages. That was the most amazing thing to me was in 1996, my first time I was at General Conference. We're sitting right behind the delegation from, I think it was from Kenya. And that itself was mind-blowing to me at 23. And then the number of translations that were going on, you know, hearing those different languages spoken, and just, I mean, it was for me at that age, a little picture I thought of really what the kingdom of God would be like. And we're still working towards that, right? We're still trying to work towards being more like, when we pray, thy kingdom come, we're still trying to help thy kingdom, to help God's kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven.
I think those are great words to end on. David, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome.
I hope you feel like you've learned a little from the information that David shared with us. I want to thank him for taking the time to speak with me, and I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. We'll continue our General Conference previews in the next episode with Reverend Amy Lipple. She'll share some of her insights as a member of the Standing Committee on Central Conference Matters. We'll see you next time. In Layman's Terms is a podcast sponsored by the Great Plains Conference of the United Methodist Church and by me, your host, Todd Seifert. If you like what you've heard in this episode, please go rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening. It helps others find us. And if you're so inclined, please share the link to this podcast on your social media channels. Our music and sound effects come via subscriptions to Universal Production Music and to Storyblocks. You can find archived episodes on the conference website at www.greatplainsumc.org/podcasts or on my website, toddseifert.com. Please email me with any questions or comments to tseifert@greatplainsumc.org, and I'll do my best to respond as quickly as possible. Thank you for listening, and until next time, please do what you can to help make more disciples of Jesus Christ. You can play a small part in helping change a life.